I'm old. So Leonard is not only a good friend, I think Leonard is one of the shrewdest politicians in the United Methodist Church. Any of you who have been at General Conference know that what has come to the floor as a representative of black people has been primarily from the head and the pen of Leonard Miller. And we appreciate the kind of leadership he gives to the church. Before he came to his present job as the associate general, as the associate general secretary of the General Council on Ministries, he was the associate director of the Program Council of the New York Conference, which happens to be my home conference. And it is with pleasure that I present Leonard to you this morning.
Thank you very much, Ethel. The question is, when do I get her back for that dirty crack? I've been 18 for a good number of years and plan on continuing. Those of you who know me will know that I am not a morning person. It's my very firm belief that there is nothing legal, moral, or worthwhile that occurs before 9. And the fact that I had to get up was in itself a chore, and I have difficulty. But you can't refuse, if you're ham, and I've got 4 minutes in which I can do some other thing. If you're ham, it's just, well, because I'm not supposed to be up till 9:15. And when you get up early, you get all these goodies added to you. When Ethel asked some time ago if I could come, I said yes, because I like traveling, and as long as the council is in good shape and you pay your world service in full, and that now gets me past Ned's wondering why I'm out today instead of back at home. If you pay your world service in full, I can travel. But when Ethel asked me, how do you refuse her? At the time she asked, she was a member of the General Council on Ministries. She voted each year as to whether or not I had a job. When your boss asked you to do something, you say yes. She's no longer on the council and no longer my boss, and she changed the date. So I had to find a new reason to be friendly. She also said, Leonard, you must write your paper and have it ready and in my hands by the 25th. And she called on the 25th, and I said, Ethel, it's almost finished. But I can't get it to you on the 25th. However, I will bring it with me herewith for distribution. It's the paper. Chuck, would you maybe help pass it out? I probably will not stick to the paper, but I want you to have it in hand. You may want to follow along with me. It's on green paper as opposed to white paper, so that it would not be confused with all the other papers you've got or will get. Maybe. I think everybody has one now, and let me just say a word or two about the assignment and the way in which I attempted to put some things together. Each of you had been asked at some point along the way to perhaps respond to some questions. and to send those responses to me. In the bosom of the black family, let me say that we have a pretty low rate of return. And most of you did not respond, so I went another reliable sociological way. It's based on what I think they'd call empirical evidence. That is, what I observed, I wrote, and what I did not observe, I manufactured. And then that's known as interpolation, not interpretation, but interpolation. And I did that too. And then I did some interpretation of some things. So there are several parts to how I arrived at this. And let's just see what it's worth. One of the first things, therefore, that I want to say a word about is that most of the black United Methodist churches would be considered small membership churches. That means somewhere under 250 members. Now, we could get into a hassle as to what is the precise figure of a small membership church, but it's churches that 250, 300 members or less, and most of our local churches fall in that kind of pattern. Contrary to what most people believe, all small membership churches are not in rural areas. They are in urban areas, in the cities where population is dense. You've got small membership churches. And so when we talk about that, it's necessary for us to think about rural as well as urban. And there may be some strengths in the small membership church, and obviously there are. There are a number of good things. One of the problems is that so very often we want to compare every church with the big membership churches. And so the Coreys or the Scotts or the Asburys or Tinley Temple and the Salems and the St. Mark's of the world are the churches we talk about, but the bulk of the folk who are black are not in those membership churches. And so we need to have, therefore, that kind of an understanding about ourselves. And there are some very real concerns. Many of our churches have people who are older in age. We don't have a lot of young people in many of those churches. Many people feel inadequate because as they read the material that flows from all of our desks, it makes it seem as if you have a small membership church, you may be inadequate. Many small membership churches have low self-esteem. There's generally not enough money. The few churches in that little town are in competition with each other. A new person comes and everybody goes after them. No, take that back. Some folk go after them. There are limited people to do the task, and one that I don't have down here under one of the concerns and some of the responses is, what happens when you have a church when there are only two or three families who are members of it? And what kind of factors, you know, does that play as you develop ministries? And that's a real one. That gets messy. I was in the Louisville conference the other day, and so Mike Bolden and some of the folk have heard, see, I meddle. One of the nice things about being on a general agency is you can meddle. Because when this is over, I'm going home. And until the next meeting, some of you will not see me again. And so I can meddle. And so small membership churches with one or two families in it pose a family. And I grew up, or rather my mother did, in one of those churches. I did not, but Mom did. And if you weren't a Foster or a Murray, and see, that's on the Eastern Shore, and there aren't many of you around here, but Carolyn knows because she comes from over that way somewhere on the Western Shore of Maryland. You know, and Grant's from down that way. If you weren't from one of those member families in that local church, you were in trouble. You couldn't get elected, couldn't get nominated, couldn't get appointed. You couldn't even get the job that nobody wanted. And so small membership churches sometimes have those kind of concerns. Some of the reasons, therefore, why we now look at this is, And this, I think, is very fair, is that there is a lack of benevolence receipts. And in the black church, there are two factors at play in here. One is that we don't have as much as we would like to have. Two is that maybe we don't have the stewardship performance, that is, we don't give like we should. But the third is that because we are now in an integrated structure, we don't pay benevolences anymore. When we were separated, you wouldn't dare not pay. It was a matter of where the appointment would be next. And pastors well understood that dimension of the problem. Now it's been reversed. Am I being taped? Yeah. Okay. I'm a bureaucrat now, you see. I have to ask the bureaucratic question. Okay. So I know how to phrase what I want to say. Now that we are in an integrated situation, if a white district superintendent raises issues about paying benevolence, he's accused of being a racist. And we do it. So therefore, a lot of folk now don't pay benevolences, don't even worry about it. Now, there is a subtle one that's behind all that, which is to say that white folk got the money, so they ought to pay it. But that wasn't true when we were Methodists and were out on our own. We do have problems with finding leaders, and increasingly the problem that we're facing is, how do we find leaders for small membership churches? And everybody wants to go to the big church, and there are only a certain number of them, and everybody's not in the big league. You know, now, some folk think they can preach, and that's fine. Some others of us ought to learn to be bureaucrats and sit behind a desk, because that's where the skill is. You wouldn't put me in the same class with a Bob McLean. You know, I go to hoop and y'all would look at me and say, he's crazy. So you learn where, therefore, the strength is. But the matter of finding leadership is a major ingredient, a major concern. Costs are outrunning the income. Programs that are often available are not relevant. And others may speak to this. Some of our programs don't impact the community, and many of us are unaware of the possibilities. So I want to suggest, therefore, three factors. I want to say a word about telling the story, then talk about helping people to get a vision and to give them a sense of hope. And those are not unique with me. Jim Thomas uses them often, but I like to borrow from him because he plagiarizes other people too. A couple of months ago, Jim Thomas and I were in an experience. He's a good friend, and that cat put me under more hammer on Friday night than I've ever been in. He was given the keynote address, and he didn't want to use a blackboard and all that kind of stuff. It was a very dress-up affair down in Cincinnati. And he kept saying, "Now, Leonard will deal with this tomorrow morning." And he went through that address several times. And those of you who were there will remember, he did that to me several times. And then on Saturday morning, I had to get up and weave his stuff, because he's a bishop, and my stuff together and make a coherent, I hope, presentation. And I got away with it. So I decided from then on, whenever I can, I'll steal from the dude. So we want to be able, therefore, to tell the story. And now, if you were a hooper, friends, this is the hooping stuff. You can steal this now. You want to be able to tell the story. And this is an important ingredient, because as an oral people, we need to be able to tell the story. Others may want to show it. Some others may want to build some models and a whole host of other things, but we need to be able to tell the story. So we need to tell the Jesus story about God and Christ reconciling persons unto themselves, about a God who creates and nurtures, and you can read all the things. And then down toward the bottom, I want to say a word about why we want to tell the story, because it's brief, it's effective, It's an enjoyable way of sharing a feeling. It can give facts of truth. It informs the head. It stirs the heart. It activates the will, and it provides meaning. You can tell folk a story, and they can get the kind of visual image that they will long remember. And the things that most often we remember are the stories that are told. And so to a group of Christian educators, to be able to tell the story. Now, the caution is to be able to tell the story with authenticity, with integrity, and for you yourself to know the story, but to tell the story. And where so often we fail is we want to take the Sunday school lesson and read it with kids who can't read and teachers who don't read too much better. Instead of telling the story, you'd have done better to have told the story. Tell the story. It's a unifying force. It brings folk together. It enables people to become a cohesive whole. The example of the Jews, when during the Passover feast, what do? They tell the story so that the youngest child catches a vision and an image and an idea and moves from that point on as a part of a family. We need to tell stories. Now, I like to visit Sunday schools on Sunday morning. You know, some of the most effective Sunday schools are in some of the oddest places. Can I tell a story about your conference? I was in church down in the Louisville conference, a small town church. And they have a Sunday school class taught by a lady who's 98 years of age. Sharp, clear, keen-minded, but she tells a story. And she takes the adult Bible series lesson, and she then makes it her own. And they talk about it. And I saw these husky, burly farmers in there, and they're dialoguing because they're getting the story told Sunday, and they come to Sunday school. Tell the story. Secondly, we must be able to help people to get a vision. And I've been doing some reading and thinking over the years about visioning, and there's an interesting passage, I think it's in the book of Proverbs. I don't know the Bible too well, but, and for without a vision, a people perish. And if the folk and the children who come do not have a vision of what can be, the possibilities, the better day, that small can be beautiful, how indeed then can they learn? And so you can see the poet says, you know, be thou my vision and all of that. But we need to be able to see the world through God's eyes and then see the vision, the possibilities, which are there. People who are hungry physically, people who are hungry for knowledge, for skills, for an understanding, for the meaning of life. We need to see the possibilities. I was on my way through the Washington airport a while back, and there was a young guy in a dashiki who was trying to get people to make a contribution to something. You know, these canisters, they make you feel embarrassed when you go through. And if you walk past them two or three times, they don't remember facing, they keep sticking the can out and you keep getting mad. You don't give the first time or the second time, but they've got it there. But this guy was doing a good job of exhortation, a term we no longer use in the United Methodist Church. But he was doing an exhortation and he was trying to tell people that youngsters in Washington, D.C., 64% of them are unemployed. Teenagers. And that's not unusual in this day. Let me make a quick test here. How many people in this room voted for Mr. Reagan in the election of a while back? How many folk in here voted for him? Now, assuming that some of you are lying, I have yet to go to any audience and find anybody who voted for that cat. Now, it would seem to me that that rather suggests that we may have a president who was never elected. I have yet to find one. Have you? Try it sometime with your friends. I did it on the way over with Grant, and the three of us in the car said, no, I didn't vote for him. Nobody voted for him. So in this day, it's not unusual that you would find large numbers of persons who are unemployed. But just take the issue of unemployment or any one of several other issues, and our people are those who are most hurt. And unless there's something that helps them to have a vision, they give up. They give up. I have a couple of young nephews right now, one of whom would not work in a pie factory if you gave away pies. Dude has never worked, has never held a job in his life for more than 3 or 4 weeks. He's given up on the job market. And I won't let out all the family secrets. My sister, his mother, has just about said, Leonard, I'm willing to now. She used to tell me we wouldn't do it. But he thought he wanted to move to another state. And she said, I'm willing to give him a bus ticket. So she's trying to provide him with a sense of hope. And and I'm about ready to help her help him. People are out there. People are hungry for skills. There are a lot of folk who do not want to be in the predicament that they're in. But they don't know the way out of it. And they're looking to someone to help them find it. And we need to be able to help them, therefore, to have that vision of what the possibilities can be and who that possibility can be in their life. And so I want to suggest, therefore, that we help them to do that. And then we need to help people to know that it is achievable. And it's one thing to give the vision. But I want to be process-oriented enough to say that you need people to be able to help them to set achievable goals. And that a part of that, therefore, helps them to get a fix on where they're going, so that not only do they have a vision, but they have some direction. So telling the story, and then helping them to get a vision, and then you provide what now some people would talk about values to be clarified, or tenets, or moral principles, or steps, or processes, but to be able to have people to achieve the goal. There's a very, very interesting passage which is here, which helps set it in context about that goal and the direction in which it moves. Lord, thou hast been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever thou hast formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, thou art God. And that helps folk to begin to get a fix. Not in the arm, but on life. And to begin to understand where there are some foundational things laid. And then to move on from everlasting to everlasting, thou art God. And that's the dependability of God. And that's important in this kind of a shifting era in which we live. God's dependable. For 1,000 years in thy sight are but as yesterday. Y'all can do that. But as yesterday when it is passing to watch, thou dost sweep men away. And you can get over the sexist language. People away. They are like a dream. Like grass which is renewed in the morning. The work of God continuing in the lives of persons. And then that phrase that I like. So teach us to number our days, that we may get a heart of wisdom. Each day is therefore worth something. And so for folk who've been wandering aimlessly and drifting, therefore each day then counts. Not how much you can con somebody out. And that's what my nephew does. He's a con artist. And he's good. He doesn't work, but he lives well in my sister's house. He came to New York to live with me for a short while. It lasted about a month when I lived in New York. And I decided that either he would have to leave or I was going to hurt him. Now, many of us get concerned with growth and decline. And therefore, we've talked about a number of kind of factors. The post-war explosions of knowledge, education, scientific and technological achievements, to affluence, to increase leisure. You know, folk now take vacations and they go. Last weekend was Kentucky Derby. A few weeks, or if it hasn't already happened, this is the Indy 500. And so folk will be gone from some of our churches on Sunday. And black folk go. Sometimes they don't go to the major event, but there are always satellite events that go on in whenever anything happens, and so they go to that. You do understand that kind of language. Some of us have attributed the decline to such things as the social activism of the church during the 60s. Now, some folk do leave because of social activism. That's not the reason most folk leave. That's what some of the more conservative evangelical folk in our midst would say. And whenever they get disturbed about something, you get a series of letters about we're going to leave. Well, some of them had already gone. It was a question that they just not had physically moved their names from membership. That's really not where I think it is, and I want to say a word about it. There are a lot of factors, therefore, in growth. But I want to suggest that the decline of our denomination, if it is a decline, and the decline in the black churches may have some other rootage, and I want to therefore say something about that as we move ahead in just a moment or two. I do not subscribe to those who believe that folk leave because they're unhappy about something. In fact, I would suggest to you that later on I won't even put a diagram on the board to suggest where the folk are. It's printed in here, but don't go back and find it now, because that'll get you in trouble. Let me say just a word or two about some things about Christian education in the past. When Ethel was an adult at the Morgan Institute, when I was a child, in the early days, did I get her? In the early days of Christian education, there were some things that were true. Religious education tended in the past to be supported by a liberal democratic form of civil religion in which we kind of talked about the democracy, and it's kind of nurtured by people of goodwill. And so Christian educators were generally people who were smiling, happy folk, and they got folk to doing things, and everybody was kind of bubbly. Religious education was also supported by some intellectuals, and that, you know, we ought to be able to examine the positions of God. And this came, by the way, from an old journal in religious education. It was an ecumenical enterprise, and we did a lot of things cooperatively with other groups. It was generally seen as being fairly practical, though it got in later years obscured in theory, and some of us became more theorist than practical. We couldn't do a thing unless we had a manual in hand. I started out in Christian education, and you know, we used to do all kinds of fun things to help make stuff come alive, and then we start putting it in manuals so that others would use it, and it got to be so stylized that nobody could use it unless you had taken a course in Christian education. We used to promise to help people to do some practical things. It was supposedly assumed, and the civil rights era taught us that we were wrong, that religious education was dedicated to justice and love. And then we suddenly discovered, when we talked about justice and love, meaning folk really coming together, that there were a whole lot of Christian educators in particular parts of the country who couldn't deal with that any longer. You couldn't go to Sunday school with them or anything else. So we began to understand that what we thought was there was not there. It used to have a recurrent theme of moral education and character education, and then we came to an era when it was seen that you did not talk about morals and moral education, and so we tended to do your own thing, be yourself. And so you didn't talk about morals anymore. Some of you are not old enough to remember that period in American history. And we thought it was concerned with the real world and real issues, and then we suddenly heard some people, and it came up most recently this week at the United Methodist Women Assembly. They tried to do some things on the world issues, and the corridor gossip, I understand, was they're not talking about the Bible. They're messing with political issues, you see. And so there's a... What we thought was there is not necessarily there. And now we've added some new concerns. We've got, I think, a religious crisis in America. We have no unifying myth about who we are as a people of God. We've seen the secular heroes fall, and we've almost debunked or demythologized most of the scriptural heroes. You can point out all of the fallibilities of them. We have a kind of a broken covenant with the past. Then we've got this whole business of faith healers and miracle workers and gurus. And we've got some folk who like to talk about piety and cheap grace. And they would even promise instant salvation, though that seems to me to be bordering on heresy, but they do it anyhow. Because salvation does not come, as I understand it, from people, but they talk about it. And then we've got this whole business, I think, that there's separation among the Protestants. So what was ecumenical now tends to be me and my denomination. And the whole insistence on, you know, and we're going to do it. I staffed the Bicentennial Committee for the General Conference, and are we going to talk about who we are as a people called Methodists? We will reclaim our heritage, proclaiming grace and glory for 200 years. Grant's a member of the committee. He's vice chair. I'm the staff. And so we're going to do it. We're going to hoop it up. And we're going to insist that all of us black folk be a part of it because we were part of the history. You know, and so we're very clear on that. But ours carried to excess, as some other groups are doing, would mean we'd not find any common meeting ground. When I was coming along, we used to have vacation church schools in our community, all the denominations. You can't find many now. It's me, my church, my little bit of money. And then we've had some formation of groups around particular kinds of ideology. The charismatics, those who belong to an issue. You can get all the charismatics from all the denominations together around the issue of being a charismatic. And I'm not opposed to charisma, but I'm not sure that that's the only thing we ought to get together around. And then we've got the Roman Catholics and all kinds of pronouncements being made, and they've got problems internal to them, but it sometimes keeps us from working together. And then we've got agnostics and skeptics, and we've got group therapists. In fact, we elect some people even to the episcopacy, not on the basis of their leadership, but on the basis of the fact that they're good process persons. They can process you to death. And we get some others, and they're all good friends of mine. I have no quarrel with saying things like that. And then we have this whole matter of value clarification. We don't talk about evil or sin anymore. It's almost a bad word. And yet I would understand it to mean separation from God, but I'm not a theologian. And so our materials are stylized, sophisticated, and expensive, and not being used. Now, the United Methodist Publishing House has a secret confidential report, which they circulated to some of us a while back, because we'd been complaining about materials and the fact that we weren't having adequate ones prepared. Carolyn has been asked to be a member of a team to begin to dialogue with them. Well, she's young in the faith. Some of us have been dialoguing with those dudes for more years than you would care to name about curriculum and its resources. But we've now come to the point where we're able to say, the publishing house is able to say, we can document why you're not buying materials. So somebody needs to help us to know what we should produce in order for it to sell. And we will have this going on. It got started most recently in 1980. It will continue through the rest of this quadrennium, because the real issue is not production of materials or money. It is who will control it. And so it's an issue of control. The money is there. The publishing house has got the money. The General Conference illegally authorized an additional $100,000 to be given to them. Illegally. And so when we tried to get the brothers and sisters to understand their illegal action, because we were ethnics, they did not understand it. So it has been seen as a tempest in the tea store, or whatever that phrase is. But the real issue is control. Neither money, nor production, or use, or even writers, but control. Oh, that ought to be worth another demerit in my next evaluation. Now let me say a word or two about some trends and factors. My general secretary and I are good friends, and he allows me to get away with this, and I'm not sure why, but I keep doing it. But I am going home. Let me say a word about some trends and factors, and Ethel, I promise to stay within the time. One in 22 persons in the United States belongs to the United Methodist Church. And even though the denomination has decreased about 10% in these last 10 years, there are about 364,000 blacks in the denomination. Now, we are down. We're not down as much as some people cite because the computer was incorrect. Computers are incorrect only in the sense that if you feed them incorrectly, they come out incorrectly. What happened was they forgot to count the Florida Conference in their statistics, and they forgot to count six churches that have 1,000 members. Now, the reason they forgot to count them is, because it goes back to an earlier point, the pastors of those churches didn't send the forms in. You don't send the forms in, you don't feed it in, you can't get it out. And so when I went through it, because I didn't have anything else to do one day, I discovered that there were about 12,000 folk black who hadn't been counted. So I used 364. You therefore can say to anyone that any other figures less than that are probably incorrect. The greatest rates of growth are in denominations that are most active among persons of lower socioeconomic status. They had the word status there. And that says, friends, that those of you who sit in this room don't reach out to folk who are not of our status. And we are a very status-conscious group of folk. And you go to the average black United Methodist church, small town, city, you will see as many minks as you will see anywhere. Everybody is well-dressed. Even the poor have Sunday clothes. We just don't reach folk. I won't say any more because that really gets me in trouble. Middle class, and that's us, churches are made up of well-educated members who are not concerned for growth. Now, we tend to be middle class, and we tend to be better educated than a lot of other folk. Doesn't mean everybody is a college graduate or doctorate, but most of the folk in our churches are well-educated. Because most of the civil servants in many places, the semi-professionals, and a whole lot of others, are us. Rare is the church now where you find folk who can read among the United Methodists. Rare. Now, when I was growing up, when Bobby and Ethel were younger, we had some folk who couldn't. And so there was a lady in our church when I was growing up who couldn't read, and I never knew it. And she would always, when you would want to share a hymn book with her, she'd point to her eyes. And I thought it was because she didn't see well. Until I discovered that she had too much pride to let you know she couldn't read. And she'd stumbled on pointing this out to you. The folk, and if they can't read, they're fooling a whole lot of folk. You go to many of our churches now, and folk are reading the Bible together with their pastors. And they pull them out on Sunday morning. They can read. So we tend to be. Now, the other side of it is then we're not concerned for church growth. Because we're satisfied. And that is sinful. The North Central jurisdiction declined in the last 10 years about 13.8%. The Northeast declined a little less than 1%, and the Southeast declined about 3.4%. The United Methodist Church is not being abandoned so much as it is failing to bring in new members in revitalized or in new churches. Yeah.
Point before that nine.
Right. Yes. Yes, before the nine. Thank you. Yes, they didn't decline 91%, they'd have gone out of existence. The discipline provides that if the membership of a jurisdiction falls below a certain point, then you change the number of bishops. And if you moved eight of those nine bishops, that one would have died and the other eight would have too. So they did not decline 91%. Thank you, Bobby. There are three sources of new members: children of members, transfer members, and the unchurched. There are fewer children now. There's an upturn that began around 1977. But the age group 25 to 34 increased as a result of an earlier baby boom. And if those folk don't get hung up on being childless, there is a continuous upsurge coming if they don't get hung up on being childless. Some of them will be. Economic, unemployment, right, all those kind of factors. Right. There is mobility to the South Sun Belt and to the West. Number 12, 50% of all Americans, and this one rather shocked me, in their 20s moved in the years 1975 to 77. Folk were moving around. Wonder where they were going. But then you go south and you begin to see some of this. You see some of it even in Nashville, Chuck. I don't know why you went, but that's another matter. Maybe he'll come back. I'll tell Buford that way. 31% of Americans under 30 were not members of any church. Okay. A lot of folk. A lot of folk. More important than theological stance
are such things as clarity and warmth and the enthusiasm of church leadership. See, I don't believe that folk leave necessarily because of somebody's theological position. Most folk, when they go to church, that I know, don't really care. If you ask them, was it a good service? They say, yeah. Did he preach? Oh, yeah. What'd he say? I don't know, but it was good. See, the issue was not content. The issue was style and delivery. And if that be true, then you see, we've got to get over the notion that that's the reason folk dropped out. Now, cold, dead, unresponsive, non-warm churches, anybody will drop out. Whether the cat's theologically sound or not. And some sermons are delivered with the enthusiasm of reading an obituary. In fact, you can get more excited about reading some obituary. Another factor, friends, another factor, and I want us to be careful as we weigh this one, is congruity of membership. That is to say, folk feel comfortable with certain folk. Now, this has been used against us sometimes by folk who wanted to say that meant separation. But there are times when you feel comfortable with some folk and some other folk you don't feel comfortable around. And so there's nothing wrong about talking about congruity, which is a safe word, of membership. There are a lot of folk who are divorcing now. And because of that, I'm not sure that we know how to minister to people in divorced situations and their families. There are the children born out of wedlock, many of them are teenagers. And I'm not sure that we know how to even deal with those children in Sunday school. For you see, if the materials talk about a mother, a father, and some kids, how then do you deal with the large number of kids who sit there who have no daddies at home? Or who have many daddies at home? Working mothers. And mothers who still work at home but don't have the time because they're working outside to do things in church. And therefore, the fewer teachers we sometimes have. The fact that we've got a lot more older people, the graying of America is a reality. And I just don't mean people like me at 18 who've gotten gray hair early on. And then we've got the young adults and this whole matter of values. Now, there are some black trends. One, the number of blacks in the denomination has declined. Our birth rate is declining. There are fewer children in the homes. There are more employed wives and mothers. Unemployment is high. And that's a factor because for us, church has been a major social event. You go to church dressed. You have to have something in your pocket. You stay home if you don't have it. Unemployment affects us in church, not just in our giving, but in our styles and in our participation. And that's, we've got to reckon with. See, if you're in a low-income church and community, that's one thing. But if you're in a status church and you can't give to the rally, you can't march when they march, you stay home. You cannot afford to be embarrassed in that kind of situation. Now, there's one that was revealed in a study done by Lou Harris, and that is that the attitudes among blacks toward the United Methodist Church is less than positive, for we're perceived as a denomination that has been indifferent to such things as equality. I want to say a word now you read the matters on the internal and external factors, and I want to jump over to page 7. And I want to point out very, very quickly about 5 items as a part of what I see as the future. This took longer than I had planned. I'd have done better to have read it, but you can read. Look down where it says the trend report. And I want to point out that we are very much moving from an industrial society to an information society. And some of you have seen and heard me say this before, but that's very much a part of what is on the horizon and is happening. Its spill-in for us is it's the factor that has caused the large number of unemployment, because many of our folks worked in industrial things. And now with an information society, that has changed that. But it also means that because it's an information society, we're going to have a lot more reading and other material. And if we don't gear up our church schools to do it, we won't be ready even for that. I want to point out that there is a movement from the north to the south. And so for those of you who are southeastern, south-central jurisdiction in this kind of a setting, that says something about stepping up the quality of what you do. We move from a national economy to a global economy. And, you know, no matter what that cat in Washington and those nuts associated say, and I have not been disrespectful of the leader, we live in a global economy. When OPEC nations or the bauxite nations or any others can begin to talk about what they're going to charge, that affects, therefore, what we spend, pay, and buy. We're in a global economy, and this business of growing it by yourself is not there. And unfortunately, many of our folk never hear this. And unless you say it to them, they're still not going to hear it. Because most of us, you see, don't read the paper, and what we get is selected. And we don't watch much of the TV because we get that quick news and then we get the instant commentary, which is already prejudiced, and therefore you have no way of making some values about whatever it is that you've just heard. I want to say something about the sickness orientation and the wellness orientation and what it does to us in the black church. And I say I'm not opposed to it, I just want us to see it. In the wellness orientation, you have folk who therefore go jogging. Not me, but they go jogging, take exercises, go out camping and whatever. And more of our folk are doing that. So they can't get to 9:30 Sunday school if they went jogging at 8 and have to go back home, get showered, dressed, and eat. They can't make 9:30 Sunday school. Or don't. I'm not saying don't go jogging, but it may say something about when we do church school. It may even speak to changing it from 9:30 to 9:45 to give them 15 more minutes. I don't know. But somewhere that may have to be a factor. We're moving from printing to telecommunication, and some of us are just getting caught up with the print material. But we're into a whole new age, these kind of gadgets. And maybe we ought to be thinking about teachers who are master teachers who use this to help do some teaching. Though I want to say a word about what I think is the missing ingredient in that. We've moved from party politics to issue politics. And just like in the church, we can get people around a particular narrow focus that's happened in the political arena. And then we are a move from a top-down to a bottom-up society, which may suggest we may have to develop our own curriculum to meet our own needs in our own places rather than to depend on the others. Now, there are some things, therefore, if we begin to see this, that we understand, and therefore they're the objectives of mission, which, by the way, are no longer in the discipline. The General Conference, in its wisdom in 1980, forgot to put them in. So we don't know where we're going. But the question that we face, therefore, is what to teach, the substance, how to teach the proclamation, and what to do. One point and then three diagrams. The first is that in a book by Don Rogers, who teaches at the other seminary here in Ohio, he points out that the major ingredient in Christian education, which I think is very true in the black church, is the teacher. You remember the teacher. You may not remember what they say, but you remember the teacher. And every one of us, the minute you say it, you begin to get an image of a teacher who meant much to you and who extended a quality of caring relationships with you. So that there is a need, therefore, for caring, compassionate teachers, for competent teachers. Competent. They do their Sunday school lesson before Sunday morning. I'm meddling. And I know it. But that's a part of the competency. They're committed. Because in smaller communities and smaller churches, everybody knows everybody's business. And therefore, you can't do as you please Monday through Saturday and expect on Sunday morning folk to rally to you and what you say. There's a quality to this matter of commitment. And therefore, as you would bring those three together of competence, caring and commitment, you then are at the point of confluence. And so you bring them together and you have a confluent teacher who's competent, committed, and caring. Now, my second one is the page 9, which deals with the fact that there are very few local churches which are made up of people who are United Methodists and have always been. All of our churches have persons in our churches who come out of many kinds of backgrounds. And they bring with them, therefore, their history, their understandings, their styles, their theology. They bring that with them. And therefore, you can have a battle royal in your church over somebody who has been a teacher in some fundamentalist, non-denominational group and who comes a United Methodist, because they want, there's only one way to teach. There's only one lesson to do and one material source to use. That's the one they've been using. And then here we are on the other side. See, that's the stream on this side. The stream of, I had to get through this. That's the streams of people. And on this side, we have the streams of ideas. Who we are as United Methodists, our theology, our history, our programming, our fellowship. And I want to contend that the group who has the responsibility in the local church for reconciling that in order to do it is the Council on Ministry, or whatever acts for it. So that the tension pulling together of people with the streams with which they come and the denominational streams takes place in the Council on Ministries. And unless we learn how to use that effectively, I'm afraid we will miss out. Second chart is that I want to suggest that, and this always gets me in trouble, this is number 10, but I want to draw it. You can look at it, but let me see if we can diagram it very quickly. And you have the folk who come to church for the high holy days, and we're coming up to one Sunday, the high holy days. They come. And they bring their kids sometimes on the high holy days, which means that at best that kid gets three lessons a year on the high holy days. And therefore we don't teach that day because that's the day we have some other things to do too. Then you have a second group of folk who come for happy matching and dispatching purposes. and because of that, and you can generally know. You can know when a family's getting ready to have birth. You don't even have to look to see. Some folk begin to show up in advance. And that's the advance guard of the hatching folk. Or matching. Some churches, you can tell when certain families getting ready to have a wedding. Because folk who have not been there for years show. And they're coming. Now, the dispatching one is the reverse. They do not come before grandma goes. They wait until she's gone, and then they come for 2 to 3 weeks afterwards. That's known as divide the loot. They come back. See, I told you it was empirical. I mean, you couldn't find this anywhere else other than in the And then you have the group who are the faithful, trusted, true, and tried, but they generally pay for what they get. That means if they come 6 Sundays, they give you 6 offerings. They come for 24, they give you. They pay for what they get. That's the majority of our members. And they're faithful, they're trusted and true. They hold the offices, they do pay for what they get. And they're basically concerned with the doors being open, adequate heat, a choir in place, and somebody to say something about Jesus. So they don't really require that the person preach, but that they say something about Jesus. Now, given that dimension, you see, and this is for those of you who like this. Now, there's another group, and this is the mysterious they. That's you. Because when any administrative board or meeting is over, the question is, what did they say and what did they do? You have always wanted to know who the mysterious they is, as in Pogo. We have met the enemy and they is us. We are the mysterious they. Now, given that, therefore, reality, most of us spend our time in a task of maintenance. Okay? To maintain this, and I want you to keep it up. It is from this maintenance that World Service flows, which ensures that mission takes place and that the bureaucrats in here get paid. And there are 5 in here who get paid out of that pot. So to continue the maintenance. But the problem is that while we're doing that, there are people out here. The lonely, the alienated, the hungry, and a whole group of other people. And so therefore, we've not found a way to cut through this in order to do the outreach task. And it seems to me that it is both, not either or, but both. And it's part, therefore, as church school, is how then do we get that? And then finally, now, I'm convinced that our task then is to help people on their spiritual journey, and that's a part of the church school task, to extend the caring spirit of Jesus, and that's ours, and to empower people to take charge of their situations. There's the task. Now, I think I'm supposed to now entertain, and we're to engage in a discussion. Any questions? Comments?